Okay, let us read. Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 through 20. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body of the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all of his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior, but now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death to present you holy in his sight, without blemish and free from accusation, if you continue in your faith, established and firm, not moved from the hope held out in the gospel. This is the gospel that you heard and that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, of which I, Paul, have become a servant. Now I rejoice in what was suffered for you, and I fill up in my flesh what is lacking in regard to Christ's afflictions for the sake of his body, which is the church. Praise the Lord. I love Colossians. I really love the whole, let's see here. Am I doing this right? Before we keep, I'm pulling it down. Is that correct, or do I push it up? Am I actually in control of anything? No, not. Who knows? We're going to be looking at the God of liberty. Before we kind of get right into the depth of this, in some ways this is a continuation from what we did a few Sundays back when I was here a few months ago or a few weeks ago. I'm not sure how long it was. So much I feel like has always happened. Life moves quickly. And we're going to be looking at who is God, part of his value system. We're going to do a bit of a recap to catch up maybe some things that were missed or to refresh our minds in terms of where we were and what are some of the points that were made last time. Whenever I look at my own spiritual journey when it started at kind of 22 years old and there were a variety of things that happened before that point in time, I can pin back to the points of great maturity and growth based on me grappling and having some type of response in terms of who God is and what he's about. I constantly go back to this in my own spiritual life. There's always more to know about God. The first time I ever heard someone teach about who God was, if I'm honest with you, I found it to be very dull and boring, and I fell asleep. And then all of a sudden, I realized, wow, this is actually where it's at. And I can't get enough. I cannot get enough. And so we're going to be looking at the God of liberty. I want to do a bit of recap. Hopefully we can see that. We could see that there. But when we're looking at the recap in terms of what was spoken about, we were looking at the question, is God trustworthy? I have come to the conclusion, absolutely yes. But for some of us, either A, we have not asked that question, or B, we're still considering that question. Either or, that's probably the process and where we're at in life. So in recap, in pain and disappointment, we ask a central question. Is God good? We all will incur aspects of pain and disappointment. That's life. That's the arbitrary chaos of creation. That entails the reality of what we live, because we don't live in a vacuum system, but we live in a world in which people make choices. Within that, pain and disappointment, and many times, becomes at our front door. And amidst that, in asking that question, is God good, we also ask that question, is God trustworthy? Is he trustworthy or not? Can I actually trust this God with my life? Because if I have any type of hesitation to the trustworthiness of God or the goodness of God, when it actually comes to, when rubber hits the road, as I would say, we revert to self-independence rather than interdependence upon God and upon others in the church. Another question we ask is, a faulty picture of God will lead to an ungodly evaluation, which will bring about rebellious action. So if we have a faulty picture of God, ultimately, the choices that we make out of that picture and that image that we have will lead to rebellious action. Next point, Jesus showed us what God the Father is like. Jesus showed us that. There were such misconceptions, and it was so prevalent during the day and age in which Jesus came upon this earth. And all the people that read the scriptures in the first languages written within the culture that they read it, they still had an incredibly misaligned picture of who God was. Jesus came to embody what God the Father was like. So not only did he show us what he was like, but he also showed us how the Father operates, which is exciting and amazing. Other point was, if our theology causes us to question God's goodness, it is not God who needs to change, but our theology. If our theology causes us in any way, shape, or form to question the goodness of God, we should not come up before the throne and say, okay, God, time to change. No. No, no, our theology must shift and change. Lastly, there was two views that we looked at, the blueprint view and the open view. And we began to discuss those two views, and I would consider that to be over a 2,000-year debate, all of which I said last time it will not be resolved on that Sunday nor at any time in the future. But it's a debate, and it's something that we've got to consider in relation to how we're looking at the goodness of God and how we look at, is God trustworthy? In the midst of those questions, we're ultimately asking, God, who are you? How do you go about it? You know, what are your intentions? Not only for our lives individually, but also globally. And I would say, as I've studied this book, and as I've read it from start to finish, the thing that I've now rested in is that throughout the conduct of human history, it's the goodness of God that is the most prevalent. I was just recently at a seminar, and they were talking about Noah. They were talking about the flood. This is not notes. I'm now divergent, but that's okay. And they said, I told the story of Noah and the flood and how God destroyed all mankind. They were very excited about this. And I kind of began to think about to myself, okay, if I was a little child sitting there in that classroom and I heard that it's all very exciting, the giraffe's head's poking out of the ark and the elephant is taking up about 80% of the boat, et cetera, in terms of the artistic drawings. But then all of a sudden the flood hits and everything else dies. I'm kind of starting to twiddle my thumb. Man, what in the world are they talking about? What does this say about this God? For goodness sake, that sounds a bit nerve-wracking to me. Would I really want to kind of, I don't know, worship this guy? Or is it a bit, you know, a bit senile in terms of his operations? But when you actually begin to look at the story up to that point, you hit this verse in chapter 6, and it says this: and God's heart was grieved, and he was sorry that he ever created man, because he saw that every thought of humanity was evil continuously. Every thought of humanity was evil continuously. Let's vacuum that statement. Let's vacuum it into a small space. And within that small space, let's have doors on north, south, east, and west. In this small space, we have a lot of people in this room. Every thought was evil continuously. When you're looking at the Hebrew, that went and yielded into action. It wasn't just, oh, I think I might rape my sister. No. It was, no, that's what I am going to do. It's unpacking the perverse nature of humanity, the spread of disease, violence, acts so horrific and so detestable, I don't think even our minds right now could take it. The evil of humanity was present. Now, all of a sudden, there's presented four doors. this evil at some point in time will combust. So there has to be outlets. And so the evil goes to the right, and the evil goes in front, and the evil goes to the left, and I'm doing the waltz, and the evil goes behind and expands. And all of a sudden, the evil begins to spread like a virus. And God looks and he sees the spread of evil at such a rate that it breaks his heart. And he has a regret. What is a good God to do when put in this situation? Is he to allow it to carry on? Is he allow it just to say, okay, there's nothing else I can do. I will not intervene. This is the way it is. They're going to choose this, and they're going to kill themselves off, because that's what would have happened. Everybody would have died. Every living creature on this earth would have died. What is a good God to do? Which brings us to this point where we're looking and asking this question or making this statement, the God of liberty. And what do I mean by liberty? What I mean by liberty is that God has provided a sense of choice. God has given us room to have the capacity as human beings to choose, because we are made in the likeness and the image of God. There was two trees present in the Garden of Eden, which we looked at last time, and that gave an opportunity of choice. Within the choice, it is there because that opens up to relationship. Without the capacity to choose, we do not have the capacity to relate. We are not robotic. We are not machines. We are not programmed a certain way, regardless of what the matrix might tell us. All these things are not happening. We have the capacity to choose as human beings. Every morning I have the opportunity to wake up to my amazing wife and choose to love her. And same to her. Every morning I have the opportunity to choose to love my children, and they choose to also love me. Every single day of every single moment, I have a choice. We have a choice. When we look at the God of liberty, he had to implement a choice. There was something that happened in relation to the way that in which the world was going and humanity was choosing, which was evil continuously, that God intervened and had to intervene. And that was on the basis of saving people and saving the earth. And so within that, we ask that question, and I can rest in the fact that God is trustworthy. And if his conduct is holds true then, and true throughout scripture, and true throughout history up to this point in time, I can with confidence say that yes, God is trustworthy over our individual lives as well as our corporate lives. But we got to continuously grapple with that if we feel in any way, shape, or form that that's not the case. So when we look at the God of liberty, we're looking at, is there a master plan? Question mark, question mark, question mark. How do we perceive God's involvement in decisions, choices, communities, cities, and nations? How do we perceive it? For instance, if we think that God either has control or the last say in every decision that has been made, then unfortunately what we do in our human condition is that we blame him. Another way of saying this is that everything happens as a part of a divine plan. I don't know about you, but I've come face to face with people and individuals that have been molested, that have been abused sexually. I've come face to face with women that have lost multiple children before they even had the opportunity to meet them upon the earth. Come face to face with parents and kids that have not only lost their kids, but lost their parents at a young age. Face to face with an ongoing onslaught of pain and disappointment. And there's been people that have met them as well, and they've said, "Don't worry. God desires that because that's part of his divine plan, and you'll be better for it in the end." And I think to myself, and I kind of consider, you know, how did Jesus operate? How did he relate to people? Did he kind of just offer that information, or did he actually shape a perception of how they viewed God. When you look at Luke 15, in terms of the prodigal son, everyone had a certain view of what the father was supposed to do, but Jesus completely turned the top on them and said, no. The whole point of this story is nothing about the sons. It's all about what you perceive and who the father is like. And so Jesus came and he shifted the perception of how we view the father. But ultimately, I think in our present day with the relation, how cultures happen, and at times the pressures that are involved in society and a lot of the arguments that have been present in terms of, well, if God's really good, then all this stuff wouldn't be happening. So either A, God is all powerful and he's not good, or B, he's not all powerful and he's justifying it all. And there's this ultimate point of reference that we've got to make in our own lives and hearts in relation to who is God? Is there a master plan? Is everything that happens, has it been present? Because if he is involved in every single decision that is being made, and he ultimately has the last say in every single decision that is being made, the person that goes up and murders the individual, God was involved in that person's decision. Is that true? I would say absolutely, undeniably, no. Absolutely not. And so when we look at those choices, and we look at whether or not is everything under a master plan, we must also ask ourselves what pleases God. The issue with this point of view is that if something is willed by God, then somehow it must please him. So if God willed something awful and evil to happen, then somehow what he wills must create pleasure. We are created in his likeness and his image. We are not God. We will never fully comprehend what he is like and how he can think and project things. But ultimately, we are a created being of an image and a likeness of him. If I will something to happen, in some way, shape, or form, it's going to please me. We have to ask ourselves, what does the Bible say about what pleases God? If we want to understand his will, we can ask ourselves then what brings God pleasure, which brings a light to his will and his desire. If we understand what brings him pleasure, then we can begin to understand what he's like and how he governs and how he operates within human history, as well as present day. How did Jesus display what pleased Daddy God? How did he do it? How did Jesus show us? Because he is the image. He is who walked this earth. It was in Jesus that we can see what brings God pleasure. Because Jesus came to bring a correct perspective of who God is, what he's like. Now, the thing that made Jesus angry was when people misrepresented the Father. That's what got him mad. And it's interesting because I believe this view of God being involved in every decision and outcome fully based in his will yields humanity to not only blame God, but to make accusations towards him. I believe the entire book of Job, if you actually read it like a court case, what you can begin to find is that God has placed himself on a stand to be accused. Read it. God places himself. He says, okay, you can accuse me. And the enemy, he's constantly accusing God. Constantly, it's an onslaught. The whole book. Accusation, accusation, accusation. God's on the stand. He's on the stand. And the enemy is making the accusations and the accusations and the accusations. And then all of a sudden an alignment comes. Because a certain perspective of who God is emerges through this book. And it's incredible to see the alignment that happens from that point. God conquers evil, not by force, but by love. I think the fact that the world rejected God's will for themselves was the reason why the cross exists. If anything, this book, as I have said before, is a book of the will of God constantly being broken time and time and time and time again. Do this, and this will happen, and they don't do it. Do this. Just do it this way. Don't turn your back on me. And they do it. God is constantly petitioning individuals and people groups to be aligned with his will, but they are constantly not adhering to the will of God constantly. As true it is in this book, which is true and right in every single area, in every single way, is as true it is in our present day, in our present life. God is petitioning us to operate within his will. And as we operate within his will, his desires, his hopes, his dreams are unfolded through it. Doesn't provide some type of Star Trek shield experience where the Klingons cannot obliterate, you know, the Starship Enterprise. I don't know if you're into that stuff. My dad was. I'm really not. I don't know why I'm talking about it anyway. Maybe there's a Trekkie out there. Live long and prosper. But all to say, it's, you know, God's intentions and desires are to be unfolded through us as a body. And the moment we begin to not obey within that process is the moment where his hopes and his dreams are not allowed to, or nor permitted to be extended beyond. It stops. God can ask me, after this is done, to walk outside, and all of a sudden there might be someone there, and God might lead me or speak to me or whatever, however you would say it, bring a sense of conviction to speak to this person or to give this person a five-pound note to get some lunch, or I don't know, who knows? Could be anything. But then I can decide whether or not I'm going to obey within that process. If I decide to cooperate within the obedience of God, all of a sudden his hopes and dreams get unfolded. If I decide not to, his hope for that moment does not occur. His will did not happen. It's in the same way in which when we look at the scripture and we see it unfolded that we have to begin to come to a point where we've got to fight for the will of God. As a church, we've got to make a stand. The cross reveals that God stands against pain and suffering that is fueled by evil, not orchestrating it. Why the cross? Which stories about the cross foreshadowed Jesus' death on the cross? Well, I could think of several. You got Abraham and Isaac. Some people wonder, why in the world is he asking this man to sacrifice his son? What kind of demented person or being would ask that? I mean, that's crazy. Well, the culture of the day was the reality that you would sacrifice your firstborn to the gods. It was part of appeasing the angry gods. That was the perception of Abraham. That was normal. Normal. It would have been as normal as in the culture that we're sitting in, they come around with the bags and you put money in it. Normal. Culture. I know it's hard for us to understand, but that's the reality. That was the culture. That's what you did. You appeased the angry gods. They were all angry, they're all upset, so it's all about appeasing them. If all of a sudden we're supposed to sacrifice the most precious thing to us, it's to appease them so that way life moves on and it's okay. It's for the greater good. It's part of the divine master plan. The whole point of that story was to prove to Abraham that who you think God is, he is not. It's a completely different perception of how you view God. You are completely wrong. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the fiery furnace, same thing, shifted Babylon's perspective about who God was. Major shift in terms of that country. Esther saving the Jews at the probable expense of her own life. She went and stood before the king, appealing to them to say, look, let's have a meeting place. She could have died in that moment. It's a foreshadow of the cross. Shifted a king's perspective in relation to a nation of people. A nation of people were saved through sacrifice. There is something there that is amazing. In each of these instances, a choice had to have been made. The choice which these individuals made were in line with the choice which God wanted them to make. But they still had to make it. They had to make it. It was on them to do it. That provides a greater level of responsibility in us than if we just say, oh, if God's will wants to happen, it's going to happen. I'm uninvolved in the process. No, we have a responsibility in relation to the Great Commission, which is why the final words of Jesus when he left, go and make disciples of all nations. He gave us a commission and a command, a sense of responsibility to grab hold of. And we as a church, have to embody that in everything we do. You can be a missionary in law. You can be a missionary in a healthcare system. You can be a missionary in waiting tables or bartending or in the restaurant industry. You can be a missionary in the universities. You can be a missionary anywhere, any way you like, because we can involve the Great Commission out of the outworkings of our life. We are called to operate within the framework of choice that God has provided for us and has provided for us to walk into. Jesus' will was not always directly in line with the Father's will. Did you know that? Jesus didn't always want to do what the Father wanted. He's the Son of God. Now don't throw a rock at me yet. Let me finish. Luke 22, 42. Remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will. This is Jesus. But yours be done. Jesus, even Jesus, had to align his will to the Father's will. If Jesus got to do it, oh boy, we definitely got to do it. Let that sink in. We've got a choice. We have to allow for God's will to break through our own personal restrictions that we have placed around it. Because each of us, whether we want to think, believe it or not, we have gates around our heart. We have protective barriers. It's part of our humanity. We want to be comfortable. I want to be comfortable. That's honest. If I said it any other way, I'd be lying to you. I do. I have a tendency to look after myself and my own. I've got to choose against that. I have to. It's my responsibility to ensure that the hope and the dream and the ambition of God occurs in the full measure. That's important. Evil in this world comes from bad choices of humanity, not an orchestrated will of God. Philip Yancey says this, knowledge can dissolve fear as light destroys darkness. Fear and Jesus do not mix. We cannot live our life allowing fear to control nor dictate our actions or feelings. When we have a misunderstanding of who God is, in particularly as it relates to pain and suffering in our lives, then fear takes root in our lives. If we allow fear on the back of pain and suffering to come into our hearts and our lives, then ultimately, fear takes center stage. Fear takes the throne in our lives, and Jesus is not on the throne in our lives. That's reality. We've got to ensure that Jesus is on the throne. Jesus responded to people out of compassion. Countless times Jesus was moved with compassion. When my son, our oldest son, Ethan, was born, he was born without us in terms of aware of a health condition that for many months, we were unsure if he was going to survive the first 4 to 6 months of his life. And it was with great pressure that we had to begin processing the reality that our firstborn son could actually die. And I asked the question over and over and over, why not me, why not me, why not me, why not me, please, whatever could happen, can you just take my heart, put it in his heart, let me go to the abyss, let him survive. And I remember in the first few weeks of this fairly traumatic news and us in a lot of ways on the edge of being incredibly frail in every imagined shape of the word, which in fact the only thing I had strength to do was show up to things. And I was leading a lot of different things at that time where my input by and large was dependent on things happening. And the only thing I could do, the only thing I had strength for is literally just showing up. I couldn't even provide direction. I was so frail. So frail. And for those first several weeks, I had a difficulty in terms of recognizing the presence of God. It was the first time since I came to know Jesus and be in relationship with him that I realized I am not connecting with God. It's as if in the midst of great trouble, he's bolted. In the time which I perceive I need him the most, I do not see nor sense nor know him. And there was a time where he was about to go into a operation. He had over six major operations, and one of his operations he's going into. Jules and I just put on a song on a laptop, and we just began to worship God and began to pray. And all of a sudden, from those several weeks, again, the sense of the presence of God was not available nor near, nor was it recognized for myself. But then out of nowhere, I had this picture of a father embracing his child, which was me. And then these whispers came into my spirit and said, at times, what words cannot do, an embrace has to do. And all of a sudden, I recognized the embrace of God was happening from that moment. God, in his incredible character and nature, responds to us in compassion. In the times where I think where we might perceive he is most distant, he in all actuality and all reality is when he's the most near. It's the embrace of God that is present and that is there. If our view of God comes from Jesus, we must conclude then that he is engaging in fighting evil, not willing it. Too often we place responsibilities of calamities of the world on God, and somehow nations and individuals must be judged, and somehow he is morally exempt from these events, rather than it breaks the heart of God that these events are happening in the first place, nor he ever will nor desired these events to occur. I take the notion that it breaks the heart of God when events happen. Colossians 1:23, but you must continue to believe in this truth and stand firmly in it. Don't drift away from the assurance you received when you heard the good news. We have a choice in the matter. We must continue to believe this truth and stand firmly in it. It says this, don't drift away from the assurance you received when you heard the good news. Paul's speaking about it from the way in which Jesus showed us. Paul's speaking about it through the revelation of what Jesus is showing who the Father is like. The assurance received of the good news involves not only Jesus' sacrifice and his death and his resurrection, but involves him providing the right perception of who the Father is like. If we lack that, then ultimately we're going to lack the capacity to fully trust. If we cannot trust God in idea, we cannot trust God in life. It is about trusting God. It is about God and recognizing that God desires to embody us and show the world what it means to love. We must show the world how to love. When we understand that God is the God of liberty, it provides us with the assurance and the resilience of spirit and heart to show the world how to love. And that's the challenge for us this morning. Is will we allow for the cages and the insecurities that surround our heart to break down further and further and further so that God can fully inhabit us the way he desires to? Because when he inhabits us, we all of a sudden have the room to show the world how to truly love.